I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
Tonight is an unusual experience for me in that I'm sitting next to the author of a book that I'm in the middle of writing a piece about, which I wouldn't normally do for fear of reprisals. I'm not saying mean things about it in the piece, so in this case I think it's okay. Laurent Binet is the author of two novels. The first, HHHH, I should maybe say Ash, 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 which was published in France in 2009, tells the story of the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, and also in a way that's very unpretentious, of Laurent's worries about the corniness of historical fiction as a form. The second, the seventh function of language, which we'll mostly be talking about tonight, is, as I'm sure you know, a comic conspiracy thriller constructed around the death of Roland Barthes, who got knocked down by a laundry van on his way back from a lunch with François Mitterrand on the 25th of February 1980, a Monday. Laurent has also written two books that haven't been translated into English. La vie professionnelle de Laurent Bay deals with his experiences teaching literature in secondary schools in the Paris region, and Rien ne se passe comme prévu is an account of François Hollande's campaign for the presidency in 2012, which Laurent was let in on as a kind of embedded writer. I'm sure we're going to end up talking about the present French election, but I'd like to start by asking Laurent about his experiences with Hollande and if there's any connection between them and the scenes of high-level politics in his new novel. So, how did you end up with an inside view of the Hollande campaign?
Well, yes, I mean, at that time when I followed him in 2012, and I thought he was a good candidate, and he was not such a good president, but that's another story. But it helped me for this book because the starting point of that book is the car accident of Roland Barthes. And Roland Barthes, when he was crashed by the car, he just came out from a lunch with François Mitterrand, it was in 1980 at the time. He was preparing the campaign of which led him as a president in 81, you know. And so at that time, his staff, especially his future Minister of Culture, Jack Lang, who is still very famous in France, he organized lunch, dinners with intellectual artists and people like that. And precisely that day, it was the Roland Barthes turn, you know. Roland Barthes died right after. So it was funny because François Mitterrand was always involved in such strange things, you know, and like very weird business like that, you know. So
surveillance.
Yeah, but many people, they died in strange ways around him, you know, like the strange suicide with the, you know, like in the gun in the, well, it's very strange. So it gave me a little the beginning of that story, like, okay, let's make that accident a murder, and so let's make an investigation among the Roland Barthes world, meaning the, all those intellectual people, you know, all the philosophers from the French theory, meaning Deleuze, Derrida, Foucault, and so on, and also among the political world. And as I followed Hollande's campaign, I could understand how it works first, and second, I could meet Jack Lang himself, and so I asked him, you know, what about the lunch? So he didn't remember very well what they discussed during the lunch because he could remember what he cooked this day because he was cooking for the lunch. And he remembered who was there, not only Roland Barthes. And so he gave me and he told me many, many things about that time, you know, which was the most glorious time of, you know, like it's always like the conquest. And after they win, then the troubles started. But so he remembered, he was a precious help to reconstruct the background, the political background of that time.
Were you yourself not invited to lunch with Sarkozy?
I was. That's process. True, but I refused. Yeah.
It's kind of hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine Theresa May ringing Tom McCarthy or someone for breakfast in this country. How did you end up being actually kind of embedded with the Hollande campaign? There was some connection to your novel, wasn't there? Hadn't Hollande's then partner had interviewed you or something and recommended you for the job, is that right?
That was that affair, you know. So Hollande's ex-girlfriend, she's a journalist and she was interviewing me for HHHH a couple of years before. And when the campaign started, I was, you know, I was watching the TV show, the American TV show, The West Wing. You know that series? And I liked it. My girlfriend, she told me, well, I would love to be, to see it from inside, you know. And I thought, yeah, I would love it too. And I thought, well, but I could actually. So I just asked, I had the mail of the Valérie Trierweiler, the ex-girl, the current girlfriend at that time. And I asked for a rendezvous with Hollande to ask him if I can follow him in order to write a book. And he said, okay. So it was my idea at the first place. Because I was interested to, and it was fascinating how the campaign is running. It was really like a run, like a race, you know, and the rhythm, and how it works. It was really very, very interesting, you know. So I followed him for several months. Then he was elected, and I never met him again, just once for a short while. But I really enjoyed following him as a candidate. And now I was quite quickly disappointed.
When did the disappointment set in? At what point in the presidency?
Well, from the beginning, it didn't look very good because, I feel deeply from the left wing, but I understand you can be from the right wing, you know, but what's wrong with him is he pretended to be from the left wing and really, like, it's not like he didn't do what he said he would, what he said he should do, you know, but he did exactly the opposite, you know, like, it was like, You vote for Corbyn and you have Margaret Thatcher. Mm. So quite quickly, everybody was, most of the people, they were disappointed. Everybody had at some point, they were disappointed. And my point was, when he said during the campaign, he was really like a bit like Jean Jaurès on a truck talking to some workers, which were like, on the way to be unemployed and fired and so he was really like, it was a very moving time in front of some big factory, you know. Mm. And then the factory has collapsed and he did nothing to help them, you know, and he promised a lot and he did nothing. And that was a very strong moment during the campaign, very moving moment. And so at that time I could see that he just gave them up. I thought, well, no way. So, and it was very like less than a year before after he was elected. And after that, after what he did, much worse.
I wondered if the figure of Mitterrand in the novel represents a similar kind of figure, someone who campaigned from the left and then governed from the not left.
Not really, because we forgot now, because of course, I mean, we are also spoiled, you know, and we are very easily disappointed. I mean, this is the game of the democracy's game, you know, and especially French people. I mean, I complain, you know, as a French, I complain, you know, like basically, I like to complain, and I complain about everything, you know, and so, but we forgot, we believe that Mitterrand was a real socialist for 2 years, and then he turned upside down, and he became really right wing. But what he did in 2 years, now, I mean, you would call it hard Bolshevism, you know, like hard communism. Like he was just he nationalized every bank of the country, you know, and most of the industry of the country. You know, I mean, like now, Mitterrand, Mélenchon, Corbyn, I mean, they even don't think about doing such a thing, you know. And like the retirement age at 60, and he gave another week of holidays, you know, and so many, many social things, you know. And so while those two years, he did many things which remained for a very long time, you know. So it was not... It was not nothing at all, you know. But Hollande didn't do that at all. You know, like after 2 weeks, we understood, like, okay, well, it will be just business as usual, you know. And we, most of us, we voted against Sarkozy, and we got another Sarkozy. You know? So you can't compare. Plus, Mitterrand. I studied a lot for my book. I read his books. I read Giscard's memoirs, and so I was documented, and it's true that I didn't really believe it, but Mitterrand was a man of culture, you know, a man of culture, and he was, I mean, the way he spoke, the way he wrote, he was quite brilliant, you know.
And it wasn't just for show that he had these lunches.
Oh, well, I mean, it was not like for free, you know. I mean, he wanted to catch the interest of the cultural world, but no, he was a reader. He was really a man of culture, and at the same time, he was very like Machiavellian, you know, like he was a Florentine guy. But it was another level, really. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about literature some. Let me ask you about your formation as a student of literature. Was Bach an important figure to you then in your training?
Well, actually, yes. First, I studied history because I was not. I loved literature. I loved books, but I didn't understand the point to explain them, you know, or to analyze them, you know. And Bach. At some point, I switched from history to literature, and Barthes explained to me that yes, you can say something interesting about a masterpiece, about literature, about, and you can like say something, add something as interesting as the book itself, you know. So he explained to me how to teach, you know. I was a teacher, a French teacher for 10 years, and so he gave me the tools to make my job, actually. So he was very important for me. Yes.
Who were the other important critics or thinkers at that time?
Well, the other French critics like Gérard Genette or the Bulgarian guy Tsvetan Todorov. He showed up a little in the book, and also, I mean, strangely, I knew more American philosophers specialized of language, such as John Austin. He was English, John Searle, his student, more than Derrida, Foucault, and because that's the funny thing, the funny part of it. Those guys, we know their names in France, the French theory. The French theory, it means Deleuze, Derrida, Foucault. So we know the names, but we don't read them a lot, and we don't study them at all in literature studies, maybe in philosophy a bit. But and what is funny is in America, and even here, I mean, I'm in London, I came this morning, and I met many people from different ages who told me, yes, I studied them at university, you know, and literature students. And we didn't in France, you know, those who read, we were talking about Deleuze, you know, those who read Deleuze, it's like a bit a punk thing, you know, like, yeah, okay, I am not interested by the classics, you know, like I will read Deleuze to protest against the system, you know, but they are not really studied at university. So I knew those guys like Umberto Eco, Roman Jakobson, the linguistic guys, you know, but not very much the French theories, the French theory guys.
And when you were, I love the way, I've read several interviews in French where you speak of Le Philosophe de la French Theorie.
Yeah.
And the feeling that it's a made in America.
Yeah, but well, it's true. I mean, the best proof of what I say is we don't say la théorie française. We call them la guys from exactly what you say, la French theory. La French theory. We say it in French. In French, it's la French theory.
Did when you were researching the book, did you get the feeling that they were more famous in America than in France, even
definitely,
in 1980?
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. In France, I was I didn't go in the deep Arizona or you know or Texas, but in the faculties, American faculties, every undergrad had read some Derrida or Foucault, and every teacher had met them, you know, personally, and had most of the anecdotes I have on about, especially about Foucault, I have to say. But Foucault, Barthes, it's there are true anecdotes given by some friends of them, you know, and many American, actually American teachers, they had many very funny anecdotes about them.
And how was that viewed in France? I mean, was it seen as an instance of Anglo-Saxon eccentricity that we would latch on to these slightly marginal thinkers?
You speak about my book or them?
Them generally. Did you get any sense of, I mean, how did it look from France that we would make gurus?
Well, at some point, Foucault was a big deal, you know, and like they were viewed as some post-68 guys, you know, like making things messy, you know. But for instance, Roland Barthes, he was laughed, he was mocked because of his language, too complicated, you know, and he's far from being the most complicated all of those guys, you know. I think, I mean, I was too young, but as I understood how it was at that time, and still now, like, we understood, like, they are big stars, but they were not like rock stars like they were in America, like, you know, I've got some. I have seen some picture of Baudrillard invited in a casino in Las Vegas, you know, with a glittering jacket, you know, and like he looks like Elvis Presley, you know. So yeah, they were much more a big deal there than in France. You know. The last big guys in France, they were Sartre and Camus, you know, Albert Camus. And afterward, we didn't really know what to do with those guys, you know. Like we knew they were famous and important, and Foucault was involved in very, you know, many political struggle in France, you know. But in a way, we decided that Sartre was the peak of something, you know, and that's it, you know.
It was downhill since then.
Yeah.
And. Who are the equivalents today? Are there equivalent figures today?
In France?
Yeah.
Well, of course, I sound like, if I say like the level is going lower, I sound like a conservative old, you know, grumpy conservative guy, which I'm on the way to be, I think, anyway. But, Well, today the problem is the most famous intellectual people, they moved really from the left wing to the very right wing, but I mean they are a bit responsible of what happens with Le Pen today, because
you're talking about Eric Zemmour.
Eric Zemmour, of course, and Alain Finkielkraut. Yeah. They are very, very, even Michel Onfray, he turns very, not very good. They focus, you know. I wrote that book also because of a nostalgia of a time I didn't know. A time that the main intellectual people, they are just talking, working, arguing about such things as the linguistic turn, language, mm-hmm. linguistic, you know, and not only about national identity, you know, yeah. which is for 10 years now in France, which is like, this is the main topic, yeah. national identity, you know, like what is France a nation. But at the same time, it's not true that we have, like now it's the desert in France and there is nothing interesting. Like, somebody like Piketty, Thomas Piketty, for mm-hmm. instance, he's world famous. But I think it's significant that the fields moved to economy. You know, we have also Frédéric Lordon, who was mm-hmm. the main figure of the protest in Place de la République with the Nuit Debout. You know, like it was mm-hmm. like a bit like Occupy Wall yeah. Street, but in République in Paris. And so those guys are brilliant, and they are arguing together. You know, Frédéric Lordon doesn't like Piketty, but they are brilliant. We still have some interesting sociologue.
Yeah. yeah.
But they are not always on TV. You know.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean we stopped totally thinking in France. But what used to say Kundera, Milan Kundera, mm-hmm. about literature, he said, and I like that idea, like it's a kind of chain, like a link. At some point, the literature is vivid in Spain in the 16th century, mm-hmm. you know, with Cervantes, and then it moves to another country, and then mm-hmm. it's English time, you know, in 18th century in English novel. Mm-hmm. Then it moves to France, you know, and like Balzac and Stendhal and everybody. And then France influences Russia. And this is Russian time, you know, like Dostoevsky, you know, and so on. Then it moves back to Eastern Europe, you know, like Kafka and, you know. And then, you know, for instance, Pablo Neruda in South America, he chose that name, Neruda, after a Czech writer called Jan Neruda. So he was influenced. So I like this idea that there is no border, no countries, like it's something international, you know. But and then at some point, every country has its moment, you know. It's like its literature is more vivid here or there, you know. And I think it's the same for philosophy or for thinking, mm-hmm. you know. And so we had a glorious moment during the 60s, you know, the mm-hmm. 70s France. And we passed it, you know, like we then it moved to other countries, you know. So
where is it now? Where are we now?
I don't know. Well, I don't know. I think you know, in America they still have Chomsky, but Chomsky it's already from another time. It's not Chomsky time now anymore. For literature, I would say like it's still America's time, you know, mm-hmm. Northern and Southern America, you know, like. The last writer I discovered is Eduardo Galeano, Uruguayan writer. He died 2 years ago, you know, and he's...
Eduardo Galeano.
Galeano, yes. And Bolaño was such a great writer. So last year it was really... And my favorite living writer, even if he's not very productive now, is Bret Easton Ellis. So, now I'm much more interested by Northern and Southern American novels. Than French, I have to say. For the philosophy, I wouldn't say. What do you think?
What do you like about Bret Easton Ellis? The reality distancing effect, or
yeah, well, maybe something like that. I'm not sure what you mean, but what I like with what I like with Bret Easton Ellis is the way he has to something I tried to do, in fact, in my book, to make his own novel collapsing itself, you know, like destructing, self-destructing, you know, like at the end of a novel of Buddhist analysis, you don't know what happened because the characters, they are under drug or they are not reliable. And so I think in a way, it's very Derrida, you know, it's very Derrida-like, the way that the novel deconstructing is deconstructing itself, you know, like really like undermining. Does it mean something?
Yeah.
And he does it in a very very impressive way. I think this is one point. Another point is what I tried to be influenced in my book is he's a master of dialogues, I think, and especially of the parties scenes, les scènes de soirée, he's so good, you know, like with many people, you know, like it's complicated to manage, like when there is many people, many things happening together, he's a master to create attention from that, you know, I'm talking to you, but this guy, he looks a bit strange, this guy, he's not listening, I don't know why, you know. We don't know, you know, like, and so, and like he's so brilliant with la simultaneité, simultaneous things.
And this is you go for this effect a lot in your book. There's the party.
I tried the parties,
the sad publisher trying to get off with the boy and the.
The dinner scene with Solers, Kristeva, BHL, and the big party in Cornell, Cornell campus, you know, and like, you know, the way like. That Kristeva will say something, which is a quote, you know, it's something clever, interesting, brilliant, and at the same time, like Guattari will have his fourth mojito and things, many things happening together at different level and put all together. I think it creates something I like as a reader, so I try to do it as a writer.
It is interesting to me that you like English and American fiction for its formalistic qualities or its experimental form, because in England and America, we tend to think of French writing as being much more adventurous in that way, or at least
much more
more adventurous with form, or at least more abstract, perhaps. Do we have that wrong? Am I entirely wrong to think that?
Well,
is French fiction less adventurous these days?
Oh, well, I believe so, yeah. I believe so. But, well, I mean, then, I don't know. We shouldn't give names.
Yes.
Because if we give... But, I mean, okay, I will give some names. For instance, you know, I mean... In France, some people, they said that Welbeck is the French Bretiston Ellis, and I completely disagree because I don't say he's not interesting writer, he is, but the form of his books are quite classical, you know, I mean, I call it like post-Balzac novels. Although the last books he wrote, you know, he tried to do something a bit like Bretiston Ellis, like showing himself in the book as a character, murdered in a novel of Welbeck. Welbeck is murdered and he dies and there is his funeral. So it's very French because it's very egomaniac, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But Bret Easton Ellis, he did it 15 years before with the Lunar Park, you know, where he doesn't die, but it starts like...
a memoir.
Yeah, an autobiography. Mm-hmm. And it turns Stephen King thriller, you know.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Oh, and so, and it was so brilliant, you know. I mean, it's a masterpiece, that book, you know. And then Welbeck comes and he does something not as good. Mm. So it's too bad.
in your first
and,
novel.
And just you mentioned English writers, uh-huh. And I have to say also Martin Amis is also a master, you know.
By the way?
Yeah, I love Martin Amis.
Let me regroup for a minute. Sorry. And what I wanted to ask about was in your first novel, in HHHH,
yeah.
You were very scrupulous, you were very careful not to change the facts of historical events. And in your new novel, you introduce flamboyantly made up elements, such as having Jacques Derrida being torn apart by wild dogs in 1980.
You spoiled them, by the way. Okay.
How do these two things fit together in your idea of fiction of what you're doing?
Well, I think, I mean, I would say that those novels are the two faces of the same question, which is the relationship between fiction and history, you know, mm. And apparently this is what interests me the most. So the two novels face the same question from two opposite angles, you know, mm. Like which is like, okay, this is a complicated, this is complicated, a complicated relationship, you know, history and so I wanted to try, two different ways to confront that question, but so this is this is one way to explain, but I mean, the truth is maybe I was just fed up because for 10 years I wrote HHHH, mm. You know, and like chasing the historical truth, you know, so. After 10 years writing HHHH, I think I deserved a bit of fun. And I enjoyed it. Yeah, I mean, I it made me euphoric. How do you say euphoric? Like, when I realized that I can do whatever I want, you know. And I remember, like, well, so you spoiled about the idea, so I can't.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. But my publisher, my editor, she told me, but you can't kill him. And I was so happy. Yes, I can. And you know, I mean, like, of course, you feel like God, you know, like. And this is a Stephen King lesson. Mm-hmm. I remember, he said, if you can kill a character, kill him. And so, well, I just say it's so cool, you know. Mm. And I have to say, it's nothing to do with most of the. I don't like every of my characters, but yeah, mostly I like them all. Even Solers. Derrida is one of my favorites, you know, so mm. I didn't kill him because I didn't like him. I killed him just because at that point of my novel, it was cool, you know. Mm. And yeah, I experienced what I couldn't experience with HHHH, you know, like the
freedom.
The freedom and the power, you know, mm. Like I felt almighty, you know, like, I felt like God.
When Simon Herzog becomes self-aware or becomes aware of himself as maybe being a character in the novel, are you doing a kind of self-criticism for your own feelings of mad power?
Yeah, sure, of course. I mean, the struggle, at some point, my character is going paranoid, mm-hmm. And wondering if he's not trapped in a novel, you know. Actually, you know, yeah, it's like a metaphor of like our relationship with God, you know, mm-hmm. And he's more and more upset and more he feels really anxious. And at the end, I wrote the last chapters, I wrote them after the Bataclan, you know, the murders in Paris. And I wrote something like, if God exists, like the Simon Herzog struggle turns to be like a metaphor of our struggle against mm-hmm. somebody above, you know. And I wrote something like, if ever God exists, he's just a bad novelist. Mm. You know? And the final chapter, I wrote it in such a state of mind, like. I was the bad God, you know, like who could decide if he will live or die. And I was wondering very long. Mm. he was just the human being. He doesn't know why he's here. He tries to manage, you know, and he tries to do his best. Mm. And so he was just I was the metaphor of a nasty god, and he was the metaphor, the novelist, yeah, and he was the metaphor of just a poor human being trying to survive in a cruel world, you know.
It's quite a dark closing chapter.
Don't say everything.
No spoilers. Are we meant to understand that Simon has been kind of corrupted by his own power of language?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is also about a certain era, a certain period, you know, like 80, 81. This is a very... I would call it in French. I would call it as a sunset novel. You know, like this is the end of something. Mm-hmm. It's very what makes I believe the novel melancholic, mm-hmm. melancholic, or what makes me melancholic is that misunderstanding at that time. We believed in 81 that. I remember I was 9, you know, I was a kid, but I remember. We believe that, okay, this is the beginning of the era of the socialism, mm-hmm. you know, because Mitterrand won. But it was not. It was the beginning of Thatcher's and Reagan's era, you know. And so we French, we were completely out of the timing, or I don't know how to say that in English, you know, but like we were, like really against history, you know, mm-hmm. And so, but just, it was 2 or 3 years after it was fixed, you know, like Mitterrand gave up with all those socialist things. And so, and then we followed the train of history. And there is also that, and significantly at the end, Simon Herzog, he's, you can understand that, some communication, famous communication agency approached him. You know, he started as a teacher, and maybe you don't know what will happen. Like this will be the managing communication agency's time. You know, beginning. You know,
and the power of the seventh function maybe ends up with Obama.
Yeah, well, that was a little how to say in English, like. I suggested that Obama will have the benefit of the seventh function, which so it was just a bit like an optimistic joke in the book.
So, I'm guessing the answer is no. But is there a suggestion to that there is a connection between the post-structuralist moment and the thinking of all those kind of guys and the kind of world of media politicians and media intellectuals that we have today?
There is, because those who, I mean, you know, what is the, it may be a shame, but I think it's true, what is the biggest inheritance mm-hmm. or l'héritage? Mm-hmm. Posterity of Barthes. Mm-hmm. I mean, who are the first heirs of Barthes? They are the advertisement guys. Mm-hmm. You know, like they are the madmen. Those guys. Yeah. They read Barthes very well, or his friends. You know, and they understood his lessons. You know, like they understood the most important idea, which was. Everything is talking, you know. Everything is meaningful, you know. Like the color of the walls, the color of my shirt, everything, you know. And so, and they used it like, you know, this is the secret of the that capitalist system, you know. Mm. They are very clever to absorb everything and to use it and to even to turn it against those who wanted to fight them, you know. So. In a way, you know, the best homage, the biggest, maybe not the best, but the biggest homage to Barthes, it's not like he's still studied at university, but he's useful for the system. Use Barthes every day, you know, like use semiotics every day, you know. Mm. Sorry.
No, I think we've whipped through quite a lot of time. I'm wondering if it might be time to turn over to questions from the audience, if I've held the floor for long enough.
Just a very quick question.
Slowly. Because from the beginning, you know, I hear every kind of English accent from native speakers. So.
It's a very simple question, really. Okay. It's the books that you talk about that you like in English language books. Do you read them in English or do you read them translation? Or have you read any in both?
Yeah, well...
Have you seen the difference, the nuance of differences between the...
Yeah, sure. It can happen. I read a book in English and I understand, but I'm slow, you know, so at some point, usually I get lazy and I read it in French. If I have the two versions, yes, I can, you know, I read it in French and I can just check from some parts in English. Most of the time I read them in French, but it can happen.
Can you tell if it's a good translation?
My book?
Any book, really.
Well, for example, yeah, I mean, some Shakespeare, I know Shakespeare in English quite well, I have to say, and I know some better translation from compared to some others. But I can tell you, as far as I know, I didn't read my... strange, because I'm quite narcissistic, but I didn't read my whole book in English, which is a very interesting experience. When I read chapters of my book in English, it's very strange because it's me and it's not me, you know. And it's like, it's very it's familiar and strange. It's very, very interesting experience. And it's not different, it's something more, actually, because it's me and it's somebody else. So, and it's, I like that so far in English, which is basically the only language I can understand, more or less, apart French. But everybody told me the Sam Taylor is brilliant, and he caught my voice, or I don't know how to say it, you know, like those who can speak fluently both languages, they told me that he really caught my style, you know, and I don't want to define my style, but so I think he's very good.
Earlier you mentioned, you were talking about current styles of novels.
About what?
Novels today.
Yeah.
Novels that are being written today. And you even mentioned talking about autobiographical novels, and
yeah.
I was quite surprised that you did not mention people like Emmanuel Carrère.
Emmanuel Carrère, yeah, sure.
Or Knausgård, for instance. And to me, it seems Knausgård, the Norwegian writer who wrote...
I haven't read
Where these books are, they are, I think they are of a different genre than what you're talking about, because, for instance, Le Royaume, which I just read, and it's biographical, he calls it a novel, and there are things in there which is about his life, but it's also really the story of the birth of Christianity, which is, you know, it's an amazing combination of what's true and what's historic, and then also, I think, what's true of his own life as well.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And yet the whole thing forms what he calls a novel, but I just wonder what your opinion of those...
Emmanuel Carrère, that's true. I mean, I think what he does... I haven't read Le Royaume yet, but I read many of his former novels, and I think it's very interesting, first. And some people, they compared my work, HHHH, to his work, and it makes sense because... We speak about story and including ourselves inside the story, you know. And so I have to say that's true. L'Adversaire ou un roman russe, I think. D'autres vies que la mienne, exactly. It's very close to what I did with HHHH. And it's a kind of an evolution from the standard, the classical autobiography. So it's true that I'm a bit too hard with the French literature today. I mean, there are very interesting... writers, you know, but they are not the most famous, you know. Carrère is very successful and very famous, but you're right, yeah, he's very interesting. His work is very, very interesting. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah. But and maybe I'm a part of it, even if I don't realize, if I don't know the Norwegian guy. Or
yeah. I mean, do you envision those kind of writers as a field of writing that you're in? Is that so?
Tell me again.
Writers like Carrère or Javier Cercas or Cercas.
Cercas. Yeah, I was told about Cercas. So Anatomia, the instant, it was really brilliant. And it's also a bit the same as you say. You're right, yeah. Cercas, Carrère, yeah. Well, I think there is a connection between them, and I think between me and them too. But we are. It's not like before. Like we are not a group, you know, or a school, or like I was in Bloomsbury now, you know,
the Bloomsbury.
Basically, in France, we had quite a long moment of what we call the autofiction. It's like an autobiography, but with fiction inside, as something which can be interesting. But at some point, people were fed up with that, you know. And so the things had to move. And now some journalist, actually, or some French writer, he said that now it's exofiction time, like, a bit like what I did with the Seventh Function, like we take not our lives to make it as a fiction, but d'autres vies que la mienne, you know, other people's lives, like Foucault, like Barthes, to make a fiction with that, you know, like, or like with historical characters, you make a fiction with that, you know. And now it's true that many people, many writers in the world, they like to play with that. They like to yeah.
So you're going outward instead of inward. Is this the idea of exo-fiction?
Yeah. I mean, you are not the main character, although you can be inside the book. You are not the main character, but you use real characters to make your novel.
Thank you very much for a fascinating presentation. It's a follow-up question, I think, to the last one, really, about the historical novel. Ashashash, I think, was a really good example of taking real historical characters and letting your imagination work on them. And my question is really, do you find it a problem achieving a balance between, you know, being restricted to some extent by what actually happened in history and using your imagination? Is there a problem for you writing, achieving this a balance between imagination and history?
It was such a problem. It was such a problem for HHHH that I made that problem the main topic of the book. You know, I mean, the question, all HHHH is about what question, how to tell a true story, and so that's why I did what I did, like showing how I could be. I wanted to tell the true story, you know, and so I explained my research, you know. And sometimes when I didn't know, I was tempted to invent, to make things up, and resisting, but sometimes not resisting, like falling, you know, into the fiction, and then deconstructing. And so what I tried to do with HHHH was always showing when I used fiction, you know, in order to make it a subject of discussion, like, yeah, okay, well, I didn't know. And this is why I made those jokes about the color of the car, you know, the Mercedes, was it green or black? It doesn't really matter if it was green or black, but it was a symbol of what I was chasing desperately. And of course, I could never really reach, you know, like the historical truth, which was just, So yeah, it was definitely the main problem, you know. And so in that case, with the new one, I was just like more playful. But in both cases, I wanted to exhibit, to show, you know, when I use fiction, because in different ways. But with this one, I don't pretend that Bart was murdered, you know. And when I kill someone who was not supposed to kill, I really want to create a shock to the reader, you know, like, he's reading the story and suddenly, what's the point? Mitterrand died. No, I didn't kill Mitterrand, but I thought about killing him in 81, you know, to give you an example of my state of mind. Like, like to make the reader just wondering, as I did, you know, what is, you know, I mean, what's going on between fiction and real, you know. And what I didn't want to do is pretending, like, you know, to make something very realistic. At the end of your reading, you could believe everything is true, you know. I didn't want to. I wanted to show that, yes, okay, remember, like Kundera does. This is another reason why I like Kundera. Like, remember, it's a novel, you know. I wanted to play with the suspension of disbelief, you know. I wanted, from time to time, like, to not to suspend your... you understood what I mean. It's because it's not the same term in French, but you remind that you are reading a novel, you know, and taking the risk that I could break the magic, you know. But I like to play that game. Mister wanted to ask a question for a long time.
And I just want to go back to current affairs and ask your view on the upcoming election.
Okay.
I'm sure lots of people would like to ask this. And I'm more interested in Macron, because I think we know Le Pen quite a lot.
Yeah,
we know
totally agree.
We know she's a bad girl, but what about Macron?
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, it's very simple. Macron is a banker. Okay. So, in order to avoid fascism, we will vote for a banker. I call it blackmail. I will, and so I will vote for Macron. I'm despaired about it, but what else can I do? Like, I would, I said it today in some radio, I don't know, like, we have to choose between Thatcher and Hitler. So, okay, well, so I will vote Thatcher, but don't ask me to be happy about it. This is what I can tell you, but, well, yeah. Churchill, he said it very well, you know, democracy is the worst system apart all the other systems, you know, apart every other systems, you know.
Listening to you, it's almost as though France hasn't really got used to capitalism, and it really doesn't like capitalism. What you just said is quite interesting, because it's always the bankers who save us from fascism, because it's never the left, because the left is never organized and is never has the guns. So it's Roosevelt who saves us from fascism, yeah. It's Stalinism that saves us from fascism, and it's the British who save us from fascism.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. Well. Okay.
And there's this kind of, I mean, I find your book very. I thought HHH was one of the best books I've read forever, and this new book I'm looking forward to. But it's almost as though France is incredibly uncomfortable with capitalism, and it's almost as though it's about time you grew up. And kind of try to create a movement beyond capitalism, social capitalism or something like that. But I feel that very, very strongly. Yeah. Whenever I go to France, I was involved in the May and June days. In 68 and 67.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I remember all that bullshit, all that crap, all that wishful thinking. It never led anywhere. It just led another generation to be disillusioned and become the bankers.
So, well, I'm afraid my answer won't be very, won't show that I'm on my way to grow up. I have the deepest respect for English people, you know, like the Churchill. For me, Churchill is the greatest politic man of the 20th century, and maybe the greatest man of the 20th century. But I would like to remind you that Roosevelt didn't save us from the fascism, and England didn't save us from the fascism. Soviet Union saved us from the fascism, you know. So, and as you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, we French, we really, you know, I mean, it's our fate now, like, it was not our finest hours, the Second World War. It was your finest hours, English people, finest hours. But the fate of the Second World War happened in Stalingrad and nowhere else, you know. So Roosevelt, he helped, he gave weapons, but those communist savages, they saved us. This is my answer.
You needed two fronts. It wasn't just a simple question. It wasn't fought on one front.
Anyway, sorry. And another, I would like to answer about the bankers and the France. I think if it's still okay to live in France, you know, it's because what happened after the war, and after the war, De Gaulle with the communists, they made social security, you know, like what Obama desperately tried to do in US now, you know, now, like what we have for 70 years. This is the reason why they don't. I mean, it's you shouldn't be ill in America. You should better be ill in France, you know. And now, of course, Macron, maybe not Thatcher, but and Sarkozy was not Thatcher, but they want to be. And Macron, he came here and he said it like it was a chance for you to have Thatcher. You know, Thatcher was a big opportunity, big chance for English people. I don't think so, you know. And we are still far from the Thatcher's point in France, but those guys, they want to go there. And I think if, you know, France is not collapsing or is not in riot every day, it's because we still have that social security. Those people, Macron and Fillon especially, they want to dismantle, you know. So I think the lefties, they can, yeah, they can be, as you say, like just angry teenagers, not very productive, but sometimes they do good things.
On this,
that's a very that's a very French way to discuss, you know. I mean, I'm surprised because I thought only in France we could, you know, like frontally, like discuss about politics, you know. But so I'm happy to see that in England too.
I'm a Marxist, Engelist, Leninist, Trotskyist, Catholic.
Okay. So that sounds good.
On this lively exchange of ideas, we must end, having run out of time. But, Laurent Binet, thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.